Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
One of the obvious signs of advancing years is your hearing deteriorates, even though there have been many impressive advances in hearing aids and implants. Experts will always tell us there are plenty of strategies to help take good care of our ears in order to stave off that gradual hearing loss. But try telling a young person today that they should turn the volume of the music down on the headphones or the earphones. We got to World Hearing Day 2016. It's coming up this Thursday. It's going to focus on childhood hearing loss. Act now. The aim is to draw attention to the fact that the majority of causes which lead to hearing loss in children can be prevented through public health issues. To give you a bit of an idea about how widespread the issue is, and health authorities are suggesting more than 3 million Australians of all ages have some form of hearing deterioration. We've got Associate Professor Catherine Berman with us tonight, ear, nose and throat surgeon and medical director of the Sydney Cochlear Implant Program. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk about the mechanics of hearing. Obviously, we see the outside bit. What's happening inside when we're hearing?
Look, I guess what happens is sound goes down your ear canal, gets magnified, that sound pressure wave gets magnified by the eardrum and the little bones of hearing, and then gets to the inner ear and basically then forms a mechanical wave of fluid, moves the fluid inside the inner ear, which gets transmitted to an electrical current, which then gets sent through to the brain, and we start to understand hearing. So it's quite complex, and we have a conductive component of hearing, which is the outer ear and the middle ear component, and then a sensory neural hearing component, which is the pickup of the little hair cells inside the inner ear and then the nerve conduction through to the brainstem.
How delicate and fragile can the connections be?
Look, certainly our hair cells can be damaged just by noise, and that's, you mentioned before, that often over time or even an accident or a loud sound burst can actually damage the hair cells irreparably. The ossicles can be dislocated sometimes by a loud sound or water skiing accidents with a pressure wave, but really the main fragility, I guess, is the inner part of the ear rather than the middle part or outer part of the ear.
Yeah. Human beings are notorious for ignoring health problems and hoping they're going to go away. Is this part of the issue that you're trying to focus on for the World Hearing Day on Thursday?
Look, absolutely. I think hearing loss is one of those unseen problems that we often don't realise that we have hearing loss, or we ignore it, or don't think it's that bad. And it's hard for us to tell ourselves how bad our hearing loss is. World Health Day is really, or World Hearing Day, sorry, is concentrating this year on children, but really for both children and adults, we should be checking our hearing if we've got concerns. And sometimes it's our own concerns. Sometimes it's the concerns of those around us that sort of say, look, you're not hearing that
Henry,
well.
You're as deaf as a post.
Yeah, exactly. And in medicine, a lot of people are brought in by their spouse with complaints of snoring or hearing loss, etc. Also, I guess, you know, if you're in a risky job, from a point of view of a noisy job, then it's worthwhile just getting your hearing checked fairly regularly. And also, if you have a family history of hearing loss, then it's worth being a little bit more proactive and just checking what's going on with your hearing, because you might have a more fragile inner ear.
I remember when we were going to school, a nurse or a doctor came round with a watch and sort of put it close to the ear and then put a bit of cardboard there. Can you still hear it? And then obviously took it away and can you still hear it? That sort of thing. Is that still happening in schools?
No, look, it's been a double-edged sword. So for us in New South Wales and for different states, it came in at different times. But we have neonatal hearing screening now, which is fantastic. So in New South Wales, it started in end of 2002. So all babies born, or pretty much 98% of babies born, are actually checked for hearing loss right in the first couple of days of life. Now, what we know is 1 in 1,000 are born with profound hearing loss, and about 2 to 3 per 1,000 babies are born with a mild to severe level of hearing loss. But that same number will become deaf over the next 2 decades. So when we brought in neonatal hearing screening, we stopped the school screening for hearing loss. But in fact, it's really important to check at about age 4 or 5, because some of those kids have now acquired hearing loss that were actually passed at birth.
Andy has SMS saying a lot has changed in 18 years. He says, when my first daughter had her hearing checked, it was done by clapping behind her head, and hopefully she turned around. 2 years ago, they were able to check my youngest daughter's hearing by placing tabs on her head and then checking the brain waves as she slept. So obviously very sophisticated. ABR.
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic.
So would that be for general people or for people who there are some concerns about?
No, that's everybody. That's neonatal hearing screening for everyone. So whether you have your child in a hospital and therefore normally they come around to the baby, or if you had your child at home, then you're given an appointment to come into the hospital to have that neonatal hearing screening test. And it's been really well taken up in New South Wales. As I said, I think about 98% are screened.
Jeff says young people go to nightclubs and listen to very loud music. He was obviously a drummer in the 70s and 80s. It was pretty bad back then because there was no protection used. You know, so you're in the middle of the noise realm and you're taking it all in.
Absolutely. And I think that's now one of our biggest causes of, even if you think childhood hearing loss, and maybe I'm putting children up to 18, but is noise induced. We've got people at 18 years old having a hearing test looking like a person who worked in a canning factory with a noise induced hearing loss dip from headphones, from earbuds, listening to their music, and certainly in, you know, playing in rock bands or even in orchestras, you can get noise induced hearing loss. So you need to be really mindful of that. And a lot of the concerts these days are at 100 decibels level. Like, you can feel it vibrating in your chest, and that's certainly loud enough to cause permanent damage if you're in it for a long time, or permanent damage certainly if you were a little bit more fragile ear.
I mean, how often should you have it checked if you have a bit of history in the family?
Look, that's a good question. I think if you've got a family history, then normally as a child you'll have it checked, and probably every few years you'll have it checked. And then as an adult, you know, probably you can work out yourself how loud, what volume you have the television on, and maybe then every 5 years you should have it checked. It really depends, I guess, on your family history of hearing loss and when other people in the family started to notice their hearing loss. In Australia, we have 1 in 6 people actually have some degree of hearing loss. But by the time you're 70, 3 out of 4 of us will have hearing loss. And for a lot of them, those people, we started losing our hearing in our 40s. So it might be worth sort of having it checked if you're finding it a bit hard to hear in background noise at cafes, or you find that you're turning the TV up a bit louder, or if people keep saying, you know, you're having to ask people to repeat themselves, or everybody seems to mumble around you.
Former Prime Minister John Howard, I think, had hearing loss in both ears and used to wear 2 accoutrements. It's one of those things where often they say that if you have that older style of hearing attachment, the background noise was constantly lifted. So you tended to over-talk people simply because you could hear it a lot louder than it was actually happening.
This is a big problem with hearing aids and why a third of people leave their hearing aids sitting in a drawer. Hearing aids amplify sound, and hearing aids are getting clever and clever at trying to filter out what is background noise and amplify what is speech, but it still amplifies everything to some degree. So it is very hard to hear in a noisy environment. But I think, you know, there's good news there. There's a lot of work going on with the digital filters and such, and this will only get better.
We obviously, the cochlear implants were developed here in Australia. Are they an ongoing development, or have they reached a plateau?
Look, that's a great question, Tony. No, they're very much an ongoing development, and I sometimes feel sorry for the cochlear implant companies that we all expect them to come out with better and better things when they've already come out with such a fantastic miracle. But each new speech processor that they bring out is giving patients better hearing in quiet and much better hearing in background noise. So they're working on a lot of that filtering of noise and what is speech and what is noise and being able to dampen down that noise. And they've got now things where when it's windy, it can just take out that wind sound so that you can just hear speech. And now the speech processors can automatically detect the sound in the room and put you on the best strategy for that room. So a quiet room, you're hearing everywhere. A noisy room, it can just beam and hear just the person in front and dampen down the noise all around you. So they're getting clever and cleverer.
Tubers, that is good. So in other words, if you haven't had a consultation recently, you know, keep in touch because obviously things are becoming a little more sophisticated.
Absolutely. I think in the old days, our criteria for cochlear implants were very rigid and you had to pretty much be a profound hearing loss patient, whereas nowadays we're implanting people with even normal hearing in the low frequencies and then dropping down into the severe to profound sort of range in the high. So we're not just basing it just on the pure tone audiogram, we're basing it on functional hearing in quiet and also background noise. So things do keep changing, our indications keep expanding, so it's worth if people are struggling with their hearing aids, it's certainly worth then coming back to their local cochlear implant program and being assessed again, because our criteria keeps changing as cochlear implants get better, but also as hearing aids get better. That threshold when hearing aids are not enough keeps adjusting.
Jodie from Sussex says, my daughter is seeing an ENT tomorrow and she's got severe ongoing tonsillitis, also labyrinthitis. Sorry, I've never heard of that one before. Is there anything we should ask the specialist when we see, will her hearing be impacted or just the balance? Are they connected?
It's unusual for a little kid to get labyrinthitis, and it can affect the hearing. So it's certainly worth asking for a hearing test, and very much talking to your ENT to find out, is this all part of the episodes when you get infection, which you mentioned with the tonsillitis, or is the labyrinthitis just on its own, unrelated to her tonsillitis episodes?
Jo's had sticky ear for the last 3 years, and I was just wondering whether there's anything that you can do to help.
I'm not quite sure what sticky ear is.
I have no idea either. So.
It could well be a chronic low-grade ear infection. So with outer ear infections, bacterial infections hurt and are often really smelly, whereas fungal ear infections, fungal and yeast ear infections, are often just more itchy and they can be a bit more oozy, but they're not sort of pouring pus and they're not too sore. So sometimes that's a low-grade thing. So it might be worth seeing a GP and having an ear swab and getting it swabbed both for bacteria and fungal cultures. And then if it's a fungal culture, your GP can give you some ear drops that treat fungus, because most of the ear drops we use only really treat bacteria.
Also, another listener is wondering about Meniere's disease. Apparently, her sister has it, and it's quite debilitating. Any help you can provide?
Look, certainly I'd suggest seeing an ENT surgeon with Meniere's disease, or else a neurologist who's got an interest in balance. So treatment of Meniere's disease is normally a stepwise process. What we think is that there's too much fluid in one of the compartments inside the inner ear called the endolymph. And so patients find that if they have a bit of a takeaway dinner with a high salt intake, they get more sort of fluid retention, and suddenly then they get an episode of Meniere's. So they get dizziness, rotational vertigo, they get tinnitus, the sound gets louder in their ears, they often get a transient hearing loss, and these episodes can last for about 4 hours, but it can be debilitating and you're frightened to go out of the house. So the first thing we normally do is have them on a low salt diet, and often that's enough to control things. If it's not enough, then the next step is we put them on mild diuretics. And if that's not enough, then we're starting to sort of pull out some bigger guns. And it's probably worth talking to your local ENT surgeon about those next steps. Sometimes we pop a grommet in, use a Meniere device. If all else fails, then we can even try and destroy the balance in that ear so you don't get the dizzy episodes. But it's a stepwise process. And for many patients, we can control things without too much without being too aggressive.
Yeah, so a low salt diet to begin.
Absolutely.
And then from there, who knows. After years of working in a truck tyre repair facility at 47, I have a hearing aid, inner ear type, that only picks up nearby sounds. But it's one of those things where you were saying earlier, factory noise can also be quite bad if you've not been protecting your ears.
Yeah, absolutely. And the inner ear aid will only amplify things a small amount. So their hearing might have, like, they're often going for an inner ear aid because it looks more cosmetically pleasing, but it might not actually be strong enough for you depending on what level of hearing loss you have.
What about wax buildup in the ear? Maria says, do some people build up more wax than others?
Absolutely. So some people build up a huge amount of wax and other people never seem to have problems. Wax is a healthy thing. It helps prevent infection in your ear. And as long as you have a pinhole of air getting past the wax, you should be able to hear quite normally. But if it's a problem, there are a number of products that you can get from the chemist to move the wax out. And I quite like a product that sort of bubbles up. It's sort of like a peroxide type product that fizzes the wax and moves it out. And you use it a couple of nights in a row and it will just sort of move things along.
What about the cotton bud?
I'm glad you brought that up.
It's one of those awkward ones because a lot of people sort of use them.
Some people are addicted to them.
A bit cavalier fashion, but is that an issue?
Look, cotton bud's a disaster. Nothing smaller than your elbow should go in your ear. So a cotton bud basically just shoves the wax deeper into the ear.
Okay.
So our skin of the ear canal grows from the drum and it spirals out the ear canal like an escalator and ends up actually on the outside, what we call the pin of the, what you think of the ear. Yeah. So it actually drags the wax out with it. If you put a cotton bud in your ear, you're actually just pushing it deeper, right down near the drum and on the drum, it's quite sterile. Whereas if you're pushing stuff from the outer part, you're actually potentially introducing infection.
Infecting it.
Yeah.
So
you're just impacting it. So
don't use a cotton bud at all, or just the outer edges.
Yeah, they can just wipe it. Like if it's just right at the ear hole, you can just wipe any wax away. But generally, the wax will work its way out and it will come out on its own in the shower.
Plunge it into the towards the drum.
Yeah,
it's an awkward situation because some people, you know, obviously use it cosmetically, but, you know, on a fairly regular basis, but you're saying...
A lot of people are addicted to it. They just love the feel.
Yeah. Don't if you've got an option.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what are the telltale signs of deteriorating hearing? Are there, other than your wife complaining that, you know, you're not answering her?
Look, I mean, definitely the family noticing. I think if you notice that you're slowly turning the television up a bit more, often asking people to repeat themselves or suddenly thinking that everybody mumbles, and very much not hearing in background noise. And what you sometimes notice is that people just start to withdraw, you know, don't go to the cafe or don't go to the noisy restaurant because they just find it too hard to hear. So if that's the case, then it's really worth having your hearing checked because something can be done about it. And it's really important for us to stay socially engaged because that decreases our chances of depression. And even mild hearing loss increases our risk of dementia. So we want to be proactive with all that.
Yeah. Chrissy from Port Macquarie says, my husband, who's in his early 60s, has really bad tinnitus. He's had hearing tests in the past and been told that nothing can help the hearing problem. I've tried to get him to be retested, as research obviously is going on, but he's adamant that nothing will help him. Anything that is on the horizon for tinnitus?
Look, tinnitus is a really hard problem, and I guess we haven't worked out the solution, but there are a number of things sort of being researched and what's already available. So often we think of our hearing losses or the tinnitus causing that high frequency hearing loss that you might see on an audiogram, but in fact the hearing losses cause the tinnitus. Sometimes people will find benefit from using some medications, and so you could talk to your GP or your ENT surgeon about some medications, but for many people it makes no difference. The other thing you can do is have a bit of background noise. So just like for us in summer, you can hear the cicadas when you go to bed at night, but when you're sitting watching telly, you're not quite as aware of them. So you can put the radio on at night and go to sleep listening to the radio, and that sort of blocks off some of the tinnitus.
It's always a good idea.
Yeah, exactly. Or you can even put white noise between stations. They're actual tinnitus maskers, which are like a hearing aid that puts the same pitch as your tinnitus into your ear so that you hear it as an outside noise rather than inside noise. So again, we can hear the fridge humming and we don't we're not driven mad because it's an outside noise, whereas tinnitus as an inside noise can really, you know, be very hard to block off from.
Do we know what causes it?
Well, certainly damage to the hearing and then different pathways. But interestingly, in the old days, they even cut the cochlear nerve for some patients who had terrible tinnitus because they thought, look, get rid of their hearing and then they shouldn't, you know, get rid of the auditory nerve and then they shouldn't get tinnitus. But in a quarter of patients, they still had tinnitus. So it starts at the periphery, but it can be made, it can be then part of the brain seems to be this vicious cycle that keeps the tinnitus going. And so, in fact, there's a lot of research looking at medication to try and stop tinnitus at a brain level, at a neurotransmitter level, rather than at the periphery. So hopefully in the future we'll have more to offer patients.
Yeah. It can drive people crazy, though. My father had it at one time for at least 2, 3, 4 years, and it really was driving him crazy.
Yeah, I mean, people can suicide from it.
Well, he was just saying it's not loud, but it's just constant. Mm. And, you know, particularly when you get into bed, you know, you tend to notice it, as you point out, and a lot more than, you know, in just general day-to-day things. What about a situation where you are working in a call centre? We've had an SMS from somebody saying, if you're working in a call centre, are there any guidelines to protect your hearing?
Look, I mean, that's a really good question. I think it's very worthwhile to sort of, rule of thumb is if you can speak at a normal conversation level and be heard above that, then it's not too loud. But if you're concerned, then it's worthwhile just checking the ambient sound. So you can actually on your phones get an app with sound pressure levels, which are probably not super accurate, but give you an idea. And if then you're concerned, it's worth talking to your boss and maybe then they could get somebody in to actually check what the ambient noise is. Also, for you as an individual, you could look at having a hearing test and just checking how your hearing's going as well.
You've already partly answered this. Alec in the UK has SMS'd saying, my wife is in her 70s, has an ear aid. She's one of 4 siblings who've all gone deaf. They all say it's an inherited problem. Is that true?
Look, certainly genetics is a large factor both in children for causes of hearing loss, sensory neural loss, but in fact in the elderly. So we think probably about a third of patients in their senior years have probably a genetic predisposition to hearing loss, and then maybe environmental factors have made things worse.
Yeah. So if you were saying that I think 3 out of 4 people by the age of 70 have some deterioration.
Yep.
It's, I guess, you know, you've got to be able to measure how bad it is. Your partner's probably likely to tell you, but officially you can find out?
Yeah, look, absolutely. I think if you're worried about hearing loss, it's certainly worth getting a hearing test. So see your local audiologist. And the other thing is probably it's worth, when you're going to see your GP, having your GP just check the ears and make sure that they're not obstructed with wax or that there's nothing more nasty going on down at a drum level. So it's worth sort of having a two-pronged approach to just check your ears.
Good God. This poor person says, my tinnitus is so present that if I move my jaw, I can control the pitch of the frequency.
Well, the jaw, the temporomandibular joint, forms the sort of front wall of your extraordinary canal. So they must be getting a little bit of pressure moving across. But that sounds really terrible for them.
Yeah, indeed. And Paul says, my friend is a naturopath and recommends ear candles. Is this safe?
It's absolute crap. So a friend of mine, am I allowed
to
say that on the radio?
Yeah, no, it's fine.
So a colleague of mine who's an ENT surgeon had a patient who did ear candling, and they sent off the contents from the extraordinary canal to the pathologist, and that showed that what came out was actually the wax from the candle. So the ear candling is a hollow candle, and they light it at the top, and the stuff that goes down just drips into your ear, feels nice and warm, and then you tip it out. But it's of no scientific benefit, and it's certainly not clearing any glue ear or anything like that, because you've got an intact drum So it hasn't perforated your eardrum to relieve any fluid from the middle ear. So I don't think there's much use in
this. This next one's right at the bottom of the page. It's probably going to drop off halfway through, but it says, can you please advise on my problem? When I wake up each morning, I have a feeling of runny wax in the ear, just like the feeling of a runny nose. I've got an excess earwax problem and have tried all the ear cleaning products. Please help. Very unpleasant.
Wow, that runny.
Look, it's runny nose. That one, that's well. Very
I mean,
runny.
It might be worth checking that you actually don't have a chronic infection. So sometimes, if you have a perforation of the drum, you can actually have a chronic infection in your middle ear or your mastoid, and potentially that can be coming out, or even a cholesteatoma, where the skin grows back from the drum into the mastoid and can present with a chronic discharge from the ears on average for 2 years before anybody picks it up. So I would say in your situation, it'd be really good to see your GP and just check what's going on in your ears to just confirm that it is runny wax, because it's unusual to be that prolific and to feel it as liquid, whereas most people don't feel it as liquid, and then go from there.
Somebody else says, has a white noise app and Bluetooth headset. Whenever they hear the tinnitus, to almost retrain the brain not to hear it has worked for them.
Brilliant.
They try never to listen to it, saying mine's still there, but I never let it in.
Look, that's fantastic. And a lot of tinnitus therapy is about relaxation techniques and just trying to switch off from it so that it doesn't upset you. Often tinnitus acts as a barometer. So when we're getting upset or our blood pressure's going up, it gets louder and it becomes then a vicious cycle. So if you can relax and just switch off, that's a wonderful way to manage it.
Another listener, Kate, says, I had a lot of ear infections as a kid, which resulted in low-range hearing loss. I find being in noisy environments like crowds driving me crazy as a result. I also developed tinnitus after years of riding a motorcycle, caused, I suspect, by the roar of the wind in the helmet. It nearly drives me crazy. Well, you've suggested a couple of things that may at least ease some of the pressure.
Yeah, and depending on...
Have you heard about this app before that we're talking
That's
about?
A great idea. I mean, again,
a
it's a bit...
A white noise app.
Yeah, look, I think it's brilliant. And I think these days so many apps are helping us in many health-related ways. So I think that's a wonderful idea. And it's sort of like a tinnitus masker, but you don't have to have the hearing aid made and fitted. You can just use the app and your earphones whenever you like. Coming back to Kate, I guess the question is how much of hearing loss she has. So sometimes one of the things we can use with tinnitus and hearing loss is actually a hearing aid, because that brings up your hearing. And so you're hearing then the noise around you much more efficiently. And in fact, it can suppress the tinnitus whilst you're wearing the hearing aid, and sometimes for a period of time afterwards. We also find that with cochlear implants, that the majority of our patients have found that their tinnitus has decreased with a cochlear implant, just because they're hearing what's going on around them more. But it doesn't work for everyone.
Kazim from Sydney says, what about using warm olive oil as an eardrop to get wax out?
That's a well-proven method. So it just softens the wax and helps it then just be dragged out by that natural escalator that I mentioned earlier.
This is a bit more serious. Hello, my son has a hole in his eardrum as a result of a massive ear infection as a young boy. A skin graft was done over the hole when he was younger. Was not successful, and they suggested trying again when he was older. He's now 14, and I've started to notice that he's commenting on his hearing being a lot lower than it used to be. Should I consider a graft?
Look, absolutely. At 14, that's a well and beyond. So I think he should definitely see your ENT surgeon, have a hearing test, and consider a meningoplasty. For kids, often they have grown out of all ear infections between age 6 and 8. So a perforation can sometimes decrease the recurrent ear infections, such as why we put grommets in. But certainly at age 14, I think you'll have much more success with the graft procedure.
What about people who have earphones in most of the day? And quite often, particularly on the bus and all around town, you see people with music pumping away. Is that a problem?
Look, absolutely. I think the earbuds deliver sound at sort of a louder, it can't sort of echo around, it can't move out, a louder sound level. And you really need to be careful not to have the music up too loud, because it will deliver too much sound to your inner ears and give you some hearing loss. So, as mentioned, you know, we see 18-year-olds with noise-induced hearing loss, and it's just from listening to music through their earbuds and things. So it's better to have earmuffs if you can, and to make sure that you have the sound not too loudly.
Tony Delroy's Nightlife, the podcast.
My guest in studio tonight is Associate Professor Catherine Berman, and Medical Director of the Cochlear Implant Program in Sydney, and also ear, nose, and throat surgeon. I've got a question here about aeroplane ear. Elizabeth's just wondering.
Look, I've never heard
of aeroplane ear.
Yeah, look, maybe you're talking about two things. So one is eustachian tube dysfunction. So when we fly, we often can't pop our ears easily.
Yeah.
Or even going over the mountains, you're often sort of trying to pop your ears. The other thing is possibly a solution to it, which are called earplanes, which are little earplugs that you pop in your ears, and they have multiple valves so that any pressure change from the cabin is only slowly transmitted to the drum. So I think if you are getting eustachian tube dysfunction when you fly, then a couple of things you can do is try and make sure that your nose is really clear. So we're opening up the bottom of the eustachian tube to have that as clear as possible. So you can use a bit of Drixine or Otrivent or some nasal decongestant prior to flying and then prior to landing.
Holding your nose and
popping, the Valsalva manoeuvre, popping your ears is great. For children, you can often get them sucking lollipops and or a bottle for a baby. And then you can try these earplanes, which are, little valves. And they're very useful. So they come in children and adult sizes.
Years and years and years ago, they used to hand out barley sugars or something when you're coming in for a landing. Yeah, that was interesting. Bruce, you're totally deaf in one ear since childhood, and you're wondering whether there's anything that can be done to help.
Yes, evening, Tony and Catherine. I'm deaf due to having mumps when I was a child, and the specialists long ago told me the nerve was dead. So I was just wondering whether any of the new technologies had provide any hope for the future of doing something there?
Look, hi, Bruce. Absolutely. There's a lot now, so that's a really great question. So these days you've got an alternative of doing nothing, which you've done for your whole life and coped well with one-sided hearing loss. But, with one ear, you would find it harder in background noise, and also, you know, you have to be careful where you sit at a table because you don't want people on your deaf side, and you don't get directional hearing. So there's a number of options. There's a crossaid, which is basically a little microphone that you wear on the deaf side, and you wear a really fine hearing aid on the good ear side, and it wirelessly takes the sound from the deaf side to the good side, so you can have people chatting on your deaf side at a dinner party and suddenly you can now hear them. You can look at a bone-anchored hearing device, which is a sort of semi-implantable device, and you can trial it on a headband where we actually pick up the sound on the deaf side and we vibrate the skull and it takes it directly to the cochlear on the good side. And then in more recent times, we've started looking at cochlear implants for people with unilateral, with one-sided hearing loss. And the fact that you had an auditory nerve there as a child means that, the sound can then be transmitted through the cochlear implant to an electrical signal that will run on the nerve that you've got there. So you've got to be pretty committed to learn to listen through the cochlear implant. But those three options are very much something that you should look at, and it would be worth seeing your local ENT or an otologist, which is a subspecialty of ENT, to talk about those options.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for that.
Yep, a lot of options, Bruce, so good luck with that. Alana, you are asking about a stapedectomy?
That's correct, Tony. Hello, Tony. And
G'day, Alana. You're wondering whether things could be replaced.
Yes, I had it done when I was 30, and now it's starting to fail, like 30 years later.
Yeah.
I have got two hearing aids, dual hearing aids at the moment.
Yeah.
But the issues for me is that, I'd like to know if they can take it out and replace it, because I need to have an MRI. I need to have some MRI scans, and I can't have them with a stapedectomy because it's the old piano wire one.
Yeah.
And so I've got, and also there may be some neurological things I need to have MRIs for as well.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, I mean, with the stapes prosthesis, they may well be able to do it on a 1.5 Tesla machine. So it's probably worth trying to just get your medical record and talk to the radiology place, because They might be able to do it on a...
I got sent home when I went to have one when they found out about the stapedectomy.
They might only have a 3-Tesla machine MRI scanner. So there's different grade or different strength magnets.
Okay.
So it might be worth sort of ringing around and just, checking with different radiology places what grade magnet they have and then what their rules are.
Okay.
But otherwise, we'd be looking at a CAT scan.
Is it worth having stapedectomy replaced?
So at 65, and you're around 60, but at 65, people with otosclerosis, they get, as you know, but I'll just explain it to our lovely listeners. The stapes bone actually turns over, the bone actually doesn't replace itself in a normal way, and it becomes then stuck in the little window that it normally vibrates in.
Mm.
But also what can happen is that you can actually get these toxins poisoning the cochlea. So often by the time you're 65, you're actually getting a reasonable sensory neural hearing loss with your otosclerosis, not just the conductive loss. So changing your stapes prosthesis can get rid of the conductive loss, but it can't do anything for the sensory neural loss. Changing the prosthesis can be done, but it does risk still that small risk of actually damaging your hearing. So,
I've got massive tinnitus as well.
Right. And so it depends. See, with the tinnitus, you may well have a sensory neural hearing loss because we were talking about that sort of comes
that
secondary to the hearing loss.
The operation.
Right. So you might have lost a bit of hearing with the surgery. I don't know. But it'd be worth having a hearing test to just see what your hearing level is. But it's something to talk to your local ENT surgeon about.
Okay.
And it's also worthwhile checking with the radiology places if they have a 1.5 Tesla or 3 Tesla machine.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
All righty. Thanks, Alana. Let's have a quick word with Margaret. You've had treatment for your 48-year-old daughter. She's been suffering after a multi-perforated eardrum.
Yes, that's right. And she's now reached the stage where she's having the sensory loss and the auditory loss. And like you said previously, it's starting to affect her brain. And she's picking up on all these high-pitched noises from the microwave and other electronic devices. Is there any? Do you know anything about this happening to people?
Can I just clarify, Margaret, if she's had the eardrum fixed, is that right?
Yeah, no, they were all unsuccessful. They tried to fix it, but they were all unsuccessful.
So does she have sort of a conductive hearing loss now?
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, she's had CAT scans and just said it's irreparable damage.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Look, it's always worth getting another opinion, but wearing a hearing aid in that ear, if she's got some hearing loss, would certainly improve her hearing, and it often drowns out that tinnitus. So she might then get a bit more balanced with her hearing. It's surprising that she's hearing the high-pitched noises of the microwave and such better, but she may well have hearing loss that's not even, so she might have a more conductive loss in the low frequencies, and then a hearing might be quite normal up in the high frequencies, and so she's sort of straining to hear, and then when you hear something in the normal in the high frequencies that she's got normal hearing, it almost seems too loud. So that might be the issue.
She does say don't talk too loud.
So look, it'd be worth getting another hearing test. She may well, her hearing might have, even though she has a perforation of the eardrum, her hearing might be quite good in some of the frequencies.
Okay.
An unusual problem, I think.
Indeed. Margaret to Margaret, you've had sudden hearing loss about 8 months ago.
Yes, very end of August, I was dizzy, I lost my balance, I was vomiting and I had a headache and I was very sick all of a sudden within a few minutes. I had to be taken to a doctor. I was given erythromycin, I hope I'm pronouncing it well, and the Sofradex ear drops. None of them worked. I had 3 hearing tests. They're all showing that I've got at least 60% loss of my right ear. I was sent to an MRI. The result tells me that I'm very normal and I'm perfect. I don't know why I'm half deaf then. And I'm still having noise in my right ear, like the shell from the sea when you hold it to your ear. It's that constant humming.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm not quite sure why. Nobody ever had anything in the family. It's not slowly coming on. I'm 60. going on 40. but never had any problem, any other combinations. I don't listen to loud music. I cannot really trace it back to what it could be.
No, so sudden sense in your hearing loss is, and it sounds like you've had labyrinthitis, so you've had inflammation inside the inner ear and the balance center, and you've had damage to the hearing. They did the right thing doing the MRI scan, so that was to exclude a tumor as a cause of this, which is great to have that excluded. If that wasn't the issue, then we think that it could be due to sometimes a virus, so you could have a viral cause. It could be due to, we say, vascular causes, so a bit of high blood pressure, a bit of cholesterol, so it's worth having that checked. Also autoimmune. So sometimes when people have this acute sudden loss, we actually put them on steroids to try and dampen down the damage to the inner ear. So it might still be worth having a check up, and they could even try you on steroids to just for a period of time, just a short period of time, to see if we can get any of that hearing back. But our best chance is actually in the first couple of weeks when you've lost the hearing. So sudden sense in your hearing loss is something that is pretty much a medical emergency, and we need to see these patients very quickly, check that they've got the hearing loss that's a nerve deafness, and then treat it with steroids to see if we can salvage any of the hearing that's there. But often we can't tell you exactly what it is. We normally do a battery of blood tests to try and exclude what we can exclude, and often it ends up in a big unknown bucket. But yeah, autoimmune, vascular, and infective. And infection is the main thing we think of, so a viral infection maybe.
All right, Margaret, good luck with that. It's rough. George, you've wondering whether treating ear infections with a clove of garlic is appropriate.
Yeah, we had problems with our two girls when they were very young, and they were getting recurrent ear infections. So we would get a clove of garlic, and because we didn't want to keep on with the antibiotics, we'd get a clove of garlic, just cut the top off a little bit, so that it was still sort of a bulbous shape, so it couldn't, you know, fit in the ear. Just put it over the, like, so the wet end was in the ear, and put a Band-Aid over the top of that, and it worked a treat many times. You know, caught things and nipped them in the bud, and it's worked for other people, you know.
Look, George, I haven't ever heard of that, so that's news to me. So thank you for that. I guess there was a good study showing, in fact, for ear infections in the Netherlands and in Iceland and such, they don't treat them with antibiotics because for 60% of people, within 24 hours, they'll be no longer in pain after an acute ear infection and their temperature's settled. So these days we often don't treat them with antibiotics because for the vast majority, they'll settle very quickly without medication except maybe a bit of Panadol or Nurofen if the kids need that.
Yeah. All right, George, thanks for the idea. Steve, you have MS and tinnitus, and you're wondering, does the MS actually make the tinnitus worse?
Yes, like overnight I found that tinnitus is really ringing and buzzing in my ears, and I get that if I move my jaw, you can control the pitch.
Mm.
But I was wondering, does the MS exaggerate it? Because it seems to exaggerate all other pain in my hands and legs and everything. And I was wondering, yes, does the MS have an effect on it?
Look, I haven't seen any studies about that, but certainly you would think with MS affecting plaques in the side of the brain, and we talked about tinnitus often becoming a vicious cycle inside the brain, that it may well be possible. But I haven't seen any studies linking MS and exacerbation of tinnitus. But that's probably somebody's probably working on it right now. So next time I'll be able to tell you.
All righty. Karen, your husband has a problem, been diagnosed with trigeminal neuralgia, and you're wondering whether there's something that can be done.
Yes, he's been on medication now, increasing for 12 months. That medication does not seem to be controlling it. He's now on the maximum of the medication that he can take. When he does have an attack, it's very sudden, and it's located near his ear. And I'm not sure what else to do now.
Look, I'd definitely see a neurologist or a neurosurgeon. So trigeminal neuralgia is irritation of the fifth cranial nerve, which affects the front of the face. So we've got three branches over the forehead and eye, over the maxilla, the mid part of your face, and then sort of over the lower part of your face. I would certainly see a neurologist, and they, if you know, medication's not controlling things, then they would refer you to a neurosurgeon to look at what they can do to help with that.
Awesome. Thank you.
All righty. Karen, thanks for that. I haven't got time to take another call, but one of the SMSs says, can you please ask the doctor what treatment for patulous eustachian tube syndrome? Is there anything or...?
Look, that's really hard, isn't it? It's not well...
In 45 seconds.
Yeah, sorry,
well,
not well treated.
Not much pressure.
It's more common, say, in ballet dancers. So if you are very thin, put on weight. If all else fails, we can pop a grommet in, so at least you don't have the feeling of hearing yourself talking. And there's a number of things that we can try at the back of the eustachian tube, but often they don't work.
Thanks so much. We were highlighting hearing issues tonight because it's World Hearing Day coming up on Thursday, and there'll be much celebration across the nation. Associate Professor Catherine Berman with us tonight, ear, nose and throat surgeon and medical director of the Cochlear Implant Program in Sydney. Good to see you again.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.